are listening to The Nature of Things on WRVO. This essay originally aired on October 26, 2001.
Well, it happened just about 2 weeks ago. As I toured the countryside the day before this event, the fields were alive with a golden glow, a signal that nature's last insect pastures were hospitably flourishing. The next day, as if someone had thrown a switch, the fields assumed a dull brown patina, except for a certain protected spots where a faint glow persisted. These still golden islets trace a pattern of microclimate differences. For some reason, the widespread freeze had not penetrated to those spots, so the temperature remained above 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Reasons for these islands of moderation can often be ascertained. For one thing, there is no detectable air movement, so that superheated pockets or sheltered places are not flushed out by freezing blasts. Actually, because of these hotter pockets, if the air had been moving and distributing the heat, a freeze might not have occurred. That night, however, even though the duration of the sub-freezing temperature may have been short, the freeze was inevitable. The clear skies and calm conditions saw to that. Too much heat escaped into space. The preceding day was gorgeous, one of this or any autumn's finest, quite mild with a bright, warming sun. If you stood for just a while in full sunlight, you could feel the heat of summer. If you were fortunate enough to have a sensitive thermometer in your hand, you could find places where that heating was concentrated. Both air and soil temperatures were detectably elevated above ambient air temperatures. Stand in a nook on the southwest exposure of a building on a sunny afternoon. You don't need a thermometer to measure the difference. You become a black body absorbing radiant heat. Even on a chilly day, you feel toasty. On a warm day, you start to roast and automatically seek a more comfortable spot. On such a day, the deep woods or the plantations resist this heating. Soil temperatures are less elevated, and there's less radiative heating. Still, the frost or the freeze may not penetrate the plantation because it has a roof and walls of green foliage. Its heat loss is reduced. Microclimates, little pockets of atypical weather, were a favorite teaching tool both in my college classes and in teacher workshops. A little poking around with a stem thermometer reveals some interesting phenomena that can be instructive. I often use microclimate stations, normally in my version, 1 meter square plots outfitted with micro wind vanes, a homemade wind speed indicator, a soil sampler, and thermometers at ground level, 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 feet, and 4 feet above the ground. Strategically located and observed at regular intervals throughout the day, they can reveal to humans what every honeybee and hummingbird already knows. At any moment, a nature center, a park, or a school campus is host to a variety of weather conditions, which, although normally undetected by us without instruments, are often of vital importance to tiny creatures, and surprisingly, to plants, too. Now, I confess to limited experience in teaching young people. Well over 90% of my teaching has been with adults, but even I can get elementary-age youngsters excited by what they can learn through the analysis of data they have taken. Children are much more skilled at assuming the identity of the beetle or the hummingbird. Their eyes and their various antennae transform, should I say even transmogrify, more readily than those of adults. They can catch the significance of tiny events. I once had a gifted biology teacher tell me that she wasn't going to use all this homemade junk, as she called it, to teach a serious subject, and she didn't have the budget to buy the proper tools. Her problem, I feared, was less a lack of budget than it was a lack of imagination. Her priority was on creating biologists who understood the importance of proper equipment and regimen in science. Mine were on creating a spark in the non-biologists that would help them appreciate the complexities of bee pastures and compost piles. My students may end up writing poems. Hers may end up making life-saving discoveries. We need both. That's why I switched from being a biologist to being a naturalist. There may be more room for awe and wonder there. For instance, how come certain of the goldenrods still glowed after the freeze, and how come the New England asters still retained their rich royal purple even after the freeze? I may never know, but I have some ideas. There may be a poem in the answer. Now, that's all I have for today. This is John Weeks saying thanks for listening. Tune in next week, and keep it natural.